There were over 200 candidates, and I am down to the final three. I told some friends, if I don't get it, come find me in a ditch for about a week and bring the bourbon, if
Seriously.
I do, bring
Yep.
the bourbon.
Either way,
That's
there's
it.
bourbon involved. That's a Tennyson talk
Exactly,
that
exactly,
I like.
exactly.
Hey everybody, I'm Evan Farmer, and welcome to Disaster Diaries. I'm here with my co-host Andy, and we're here to interview people who have literally lost everything and survived to tell us how they rebuilt.
I'm Andy, and we're diving into the human side of disaster recovery, the grief, the grit, and the guts it takes to start over.
All right, so thanks for tuning in, and without further ado, let's jump into today's episode. Hey, if you shop at Home Depot, this is a no-brainer. Our free Build SOS program unlocks verified discounts, often up to 30%, plus access to exclusive deals on tools and materials. It is especially useful for contractors, handymen, and DIYers who buy regularly. No fees, no gimmicks, just better prices at checkout. All you have to do is click the link below or in the show notes that says Build SOS with Home Depot to start saving. Welcome to Disaster Diaries. I'm Evan Farmer. So Andy met today's guest through a mutual friend, and after hearing his story, immediately invited him on to talk about his experience on our show. Imagine starting a new job as CEO of the Home Builders Association of Greater New Orleans, and then just 7 days later, Hurricane Katrina hits. Today's guest, John Luther, lived that reality, and what he learned about leadership, chaos, and rebuilding is a big part of what's setting the bar for disaster recovery today.
John, I wanted to just, say thank you for joining us, and I'll let Evan introduce himself. And we met the other day on a great call through Mike, one of the board members, and it was a fantastic conversation, and I knew I had to talk to you more about all this. So, Evan, I'll turn it over to you, and then John, if you want to just give us a little bit of kind of who you are, because this is more than just a personal story about a disaster.
Well, John, welcome to Disaster Diaries, and
thank
you for taking the time to do this. And I know that you guys have a little bit of a background, so I'm not going to take over hosting role like so much at this point, because there's some history there, and it's becoming more and more apparent that these shared stories are what helps people prepare. It helps them also kind of cope and deal, and it also helps people recover in a lot of ways. So we're a beautiful mess. So anyway, thank you and
great,
welcome.
Great.
And I'll give the floor to you.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate it. And I'm delighted to be here. I can start, or will start, if you will, on how I ended up in Louisiana. I don't want to belabor or bore you with my whole life story, but I can tell you, kind of the transition to Louisiana, which set me up for the rest of my life, so to speak. I was in D.C. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, very blue collar, kind of humble upbringing. When I graduated undergraduate school from the University of Pittsburgh, the economy was horrible. I moved to D.C. about 5 hours away and made my life there. I was in my early 20s. And I started out essentially working for Congress. I worked for the House of Representatives. That was a pretty good gig. My congressman lost his election, so I was out of a job. And so I thought, oh, I need to transition. So I went into the trade association world, a couple different stops. One of which, while I was there, I ended up going to law school at Catholic University in D.C. And I really started to take a liking through that to real estate and real estate development and home construction and so forth. So I started to migrate that way. Got a job as an attorney at a firm in Rockville, Maryland, representing builders and developers and, those on that creative side, so to speak. Transitioned then to the in-house counsel at the National Association of Home Builders. That then kind of got me out there nationally, because I was doing legal programs for our builders, working with some of our urban planners, and we were, being quite creative with our programming. And we started giving these programs at the National Association's International Builders Show. Well, that hit really big. We spoke to groups of 600, 700, 800 people, and we started getting invited all throughout the country to home builders groups and kind of sitting in the first and second chair. They would take us then to their county and municipal, policymakers, and we would try to work with them to see if we couldn't work together, to help them finance their infrastructure or whatever it is that they were regulating. Maybe we could help them out and work more collaboratively instead of always being on, opposing sides. Worked really well to the point that I got invited to do a program at the Louisiana State Board of Directors, the Home Builders Association in Baton Rouge. The fellow who invited us, was there with somebody from Kohler, who was providing his plumbing and all of that kind of good stuff. So happened she was a beautiful woman. So happens he introduced us, and
As
so
it
we started
happens.
dating long distance. She would come to DC, I would come to New Orleans, and that went on for X amount of months. We get engaged, and she moves to DC. Well, she is a New Orleans girl through and through and through. And she was there all of maybe 6 weeks, and it was too cold. She missed her mama. She missed New Orleans. And I knew I had a big decision ahead of me. I'd been in DC at that point about 15 years, and she wanted to come home, home meaning New Orleans. At that same time, the fellow who was the CEO of the New Orleans Home Builders Association, who had been there about 10 years, he was moving back to where he was from originally in Florida. So the position opened up. And I interviewed a couple of times and got the job.
And what year was
And
this?
this would have been 2005.
Course, you got
August
to
of
win.
two, well, I got the job in July of 2005. By the time I got all my ducks lined up, bought a new house in Slidell, Louisiana, got all my earthly possessions, drove them 1,000 miles in a U-Haul, settled into my house, and I started my new job at the Home Builders Association August 16th of 2005. And so the way the work days sketched out, I was on the job 7 days when Hurricane Katrina hit. Really, still didn't even know most of my board, didn't even know my staff. I had about I inherited a staff of about seven or eight, I guess.
There is the absolute timing of 7 days before you getting this role, but then there's the personal aspect of this. And I wanted to ask you just moved your whole life to Slidell, right? And for those who don't know Slidell, it's basically New Orleans, just a little farther out. And what was going through? Can you walk us through, like, what was going through your mind as you watched? Because Katrina, there were some surprises. The levee broke, that was a
No
surprise.
doubt.
But there was
No doubt.
a quite a lead up in the news to, hey, this thing is coming. So do you remember from a personal and I guess also professional point of view, as this was arriving, what was going through your mind? What did you get up and do every day? And was there the, I'm going to leave everything in the truck in case I have to just drive it away?
We got to the point where a day and a half, 2 days out, it's an inevitability that it's going to hit somewhere around here. And essentially, it got to the point where my wife is begging her father now to leave. He still wasn't too hip on the idea. His wife, my mother-in-law, wanted to leave. My wife is distraught. She did try to go to sleep for a little while. And I was watching this feature on the news, live news, and one of the reporters was out meeting with this fella way out in St. Bernard Parish, area called Shell Beach. And his name was Blackie Campo. And Blackie Campo was legendary out there in the fishing community. He was probably 90 at that time. And the reporter asked him, Blackie, what are you going to do? Now, this is me watching this probably like live at 2 o'clock in the morning. And Blackie, he had this old crooked finger and he looked at the guy and he said, Sonny, he said, I stayed four. And he probably rattled off 10 different storms in 40 years that he never evacuated for. But he said to the reporter, he said, I'm getting out of here for this one. Well, I ran into my wife. I woke her up. I said, call your dad. Blackie Campo's leaving. And so I knew that might resonate with me, and it did. And it did.
You've gone through the personal piece, and you were so there's a moment where you're shifting to, all right, I'm in this new role. And you didn't just take over a cupcake shop down the street type of thing. You are absolutely central. You are over the Home Builders Association of the area that just got wiped out
Correct,
historically.
correct.
Right?
Yes,
So
sir.
what goes through your head with being fresh in that role? What am I supposed to do? I'm so fascinated. What wake up in the morning and say, okay, here's
Well,
what I'm going to do.
what's wild, Andy, is I was overwhelmed then, and I almost feel overwhelmed now because we could go on for days with this, and I'm just trying to think how to put it together and frame it as succinctly as I possibly can. We had almost, I think, 900 member firms that I was responsible for developers and builders, and then anybody conceivably supporting the trades from flooring to insulation to mortgage bankers. I mean, you name it. And they were complete. I mean, the lines of communication were completely disrupted. We then learned that our building got hit pretty badly. My own personal office, I think, had 2 or 3 feet of water. The rest of the building got beat up pretty badly. It was still standing and it was somewhat habitable. While all of this is going on, my wife and I were pregnant with our first child. And you might imagine we were really afraid because the stress of this, and she was 8 plus months pregnant at the time, the stress of all of this, we were terrified that, maybe something had happened. So we, again, I could go back and forth and I don't mean to jump around so much, but
Please.
so we go finally to get her an exam, and everybody that the place was really nice. It was in Kingwood, Texas, just a little north of where we were staying. Everybody, was very, very humble and polite and kind and generous to us. She had her exam. Everything was fine. We're exiting the building and we didn't go out the way we had come in. They took us somewhere else. They take us into this cafeteria. It was dark. We get halfway in there. They turn the lights on. They had an impromptu baby shower for us. And we were blown away. We were blown away. We both started crying. Those people in that short amount of time knew what we were up against. And while we were meeting with the doctor, they literally got together and put a little baby shower together for us.
Amazing.
So at any rate, getting back, so it was a back and forth kind of transit, and got to the point that, we're starting to see a little bit of activity. Well, I finally get the chance to go see my home. That was the first in several weeks that I was able to get to see my home. And we had to go through two National Guard checkpoints, and I was okay with that. I mean, because I figured they're protecting my property, but these guys, you might imagine, they were all camoed out and they had their M16s and whatever else they were carrying. So it was pretty intimidating, but I didn't feel that way. I felt comfortable because I thought, okay, well, they're taking care of me. So we finally get to my property. My guy Randy, who's a developer and a builder, knows the inside of a house like probably like nobody else I've ever met. He was literally up in my rafters in the attic, and it's we have no electricity. It's 97, 98 degrees. The guy's soaked and whatever, and he said your house did just fine. So that was nice. We had some holes in the roof, some water came in, and wall repair and what have you, but no flooding. So during that time, we're trying to reach out to members, and we finally kind of after X amount of weeks or what have you, thought and realized we probably had lost at least 200 or so member firms.
When you
I'm
say
sorry.
them, what do you mean by lost? Like you couldn't locate them and communicate with them, or they reported back and said business is gone. Like I lost everything.
Yes.
Oh my God.
We couldn't
Both.
make communication with them. They maybe lost their own home, maybe they lost their business, or maybe they didn't lose anything, but they were no kind of place to even try to run a business. Maybe their employees were in Texas and in Alabama and Florida, and it was just a complete dispersal of people and resources. And so they may or may not have come back. And so we work very closely with our national association where I used to work in DC, which I was very fortunate and blessed to have those relationships from the CEO on down. And they, of course, started to provide every resource they could for us. At a minimum, they allowed us to we because the way we're set up, we would report dues, local associations report dues to the national, and so they immediately suspended that until, another a future time. They yes, sir.
So I just have a question. So the HBA, so not everybody listening might know what an HBA is, but I'm curious if you can tell us what an HBA does for its members. And then I'm really curious whether in this moment when you're talking with National, was there a conversation around, I know we usually do X, Y, and Z, but we really have to do more for our people. I mean, did you expand the role?
Yes to all of that.
What is the NAHB, just so everybody knows exactly what
Sure,
they do first?
it's the National Association of Home Builders, and it's the preeminent professional home building trade association in the country. It's comprised of companies that, pay an annual fee or an annual dues, and for in return, what they get for that is a multitude of services. the developers and builders are real interested in legislative and lobbying and legal services because they're getting regulated and sued and so forth. And so they have access to that. That's what I did when I was working at NAHB in the general counsel's office. I was an NAHB lawyer, and so I would provide, assist with legal services with all these home builders. They also have great continuing education and training. And so, the construction industry and everything supporting it, they provide a venue for big events, for the industry to get together and to do business. And, the so-called builder members and the associate members who are non-builders, they can do business together. And the largest such forum is the International Builders Show, the IBS. So NAHB runs that every year in Vegas or Orlando, essentially. So that's another big piece of it. They have professional services to help the member companies run their businesses better, run for profit, how to insure it, how to finance it, how to do succession planning. So there's a multitude of services that these associations, from the NAHB to the state association to the local, they call it a federation. So it's essentially threefold. It's a local association, and this is all over the country. It's a local association that belongs to the state association, and then they both and all the other local associations in that state belong to the National Association. They flew me to Jackson, Mississippi for a big emergency meeting to try to help me back on the ground with resources, with technical knowledge, with the works. You might imagine, just not only was I overwhelmed for various reasons, everybody around me was. Well, that was a pivotal moment for me and a pivotal meeting. And in fact, I think it changed the dynamic for me, and I didn't even realize it then. I'm in the corridor of the hotel, and a fella comes up to me, and I knew I recognized him. And it turns out I had worked with him at the National Association in DC. It was a big place, though. And so I would see him in the hallways. At that time, there's probably 250 employees. And I'd say hello to him, whatever, but we really didn't know each other very well. Well, I see him and he comes up to me and he knew me clearly and he kind of comes up into my face and he said, "Are you okay?" I said, I think so. Yeah, why?" He says, "Your family okay?" I said, "Yeah, I think so. I said, we're just trying to sift through everything." And that was it. That was the rest of the small talk was over. He kind of got up even closer to me, and believe it or not, however it happened, I was in a suit and tie that day. He grabbed my lapels of my suit and he said, "Well, do me a favor." And I said, "Okay." And he said, and he kind of did one of these, pointed on my, he said, "Make some damn decisions." And I looked at him, I said, "Okay." He said, "Because everybody around you," he said, "probably your governor, your mayor, maybe your members, maybe the media, maybe policy," but he says, "they're all going to be paralyzed by indecision." He said, "Make some damn decisions." He said, "Guess what? A lot of those decisions might be wrong, but make them." He said, "Because the decisions that you have to make, if you don't, they are going to compound on you and spiral and snowball. And then when you still have to go make it, it'll be too big for you." Well, this guy turns out to be a guy named Ken Ford. And at that time, Ken had been with the National Association about 25 years. And again, shame on me for not knowing him better when I worked with him, but they called him the Master of Disaster. Ken Ford's job, he was a codes expert. His job was to go out California, if it's a forest fire, an earthquake, Oklahoma, if it's a tornado, Minneapolis, if it's a flood, obviously the Gulf South, if there's hurricanes. His job was to go out there and educate not only the membership, but then to have take him with us to go educate all the people we would be interfacing with, whether the media, whether the policymakers and whomever. Well, this guy had contacts like you would not believe from doing this all these years with the agencies we needed the most: FEMA, a HUD, SBA, Small Business Administration, EPA. It runs the gamut. And what he would do, we became fast friends after that Jackson, Mississippi meeting, to the point of being so close, he came down probably no less than 30 times in the course of a couple of years to assist me and to assist our HBA in our region. We became so close, he stopped staying at hotels. He'd stay at my house once we finally were back in it. And what he would do was reach out to his network and bring them to us, whatever hotel ballroom we could find. He would bring a FEMA representative or a local floodplain manager or somebody from the NFIP or somebody from State Farm or somebody from the Red Cross. You know, this guy's reach was just amazing. And so he helped me then expand the offerings that I had as we started kind of continuing to make contact with all of our members, because they all had these needs. You know, they mostly, probably the most identifiable early short-term need that all of my members needed was short-term bridge financing. They just needed a few to 10,000 or so to try to just make it to that next couple of weeks. And we were literally living like that because, you know, most of these Home Builders Association members, and ours certainly in New Orleans, were small businesses. You know, we didn't have the real big publicly traded companies, at least as builders. You know, maybe some of the vendors and suppliers came from big companies. So that was the first piece. Well, the relation. Yes, sir.
Did you get the sense that these builders, well, two questions. One is, did you get the sense that they were prepared at all for what was coming? And I mean, from a construction point of view, their job sites, their procedures, was there anything in place with any of them to prepare for this type of eventuality? And the second thing I was wondering is, when you went to reach out to them, was it an open, what do you need? Or was it more of a structured, can I help you in this way, this way, and this way? What were the mechanics of that?
To your first question, the answer is no. Nobody was prepared for it. Nobody. And not even just in our industry, in most any of the industries around here. Nobody was prepared for anything of this scale. You make a great point, because my colleagues from other parts of the country started, when they could make contact with me, those CEOs of other home builders associations, when they would make contact, you know, of course they felt horrible. Even my national organization, my national CEO, they would call and they say, you know, what do you need? What can we do for you? And in retrospect, and I started doing a lot of public speaking on these issues later on, still do even. In retrospect, I look at it, it's an easy answer. But at the time, it was a terribly difficult answer because of the adrenaline, the just human emotion of it. I would almost try to brush them off. Oh, we're okay. No, we're good. We're good. We're good. We weren't good by any stretch of the imagination. But I had so much on my plate that I didn't know what to tell them then what it is we needed. I didn't learn that until several hurricanes later that I'd been involved in, not only just in Louisiana. I'd gone out and helped in Florida and Puerto Rico and Texas and New York and so forth. What I realized, and what I would have on my PowerPoint slides when I would do programming, was be ready for that question. When somebody says, what can I do for you? What do you need? Be ready, be specific, because a few things might happen. You might not hear from them again. They might not have the resources 6 months, a year from then. So be specific. You know, it could be anything from, gosh, you know, our organization lost so many members and so forth. You know, it would be really helpful. Our businesses are struggling, you know, maybe gift cards from Home Depot or geez, you know. So we started to get gifts, and they were gifts. They were very generous gifts from a lot of our sister associations in our national. A lot of times it was a check for cash. A lot of times it was these gift cards. It could be, you know, it could be anything. That it could be a case of diapers for members, kids who can't find diapers. I mean, it just, you could, if you think about the item, it was in shortage, frankly. And so a lot of that went on for a while. And I got a little better at being able to answer that question. But at the same time, I still wished I had been better in retrospect, because I could have probably gleaned more resources more directly. But hey, and so that is kind of how we started to emerge in the realm of, okay, we're alive. We have a building damaged. We're going to have to do repairs. While I didn't have carpet in my office, I think, for almost 3 years. I was on concrete for about 3 years, because, and the builders will tell you, so many of them that had their homes destroyed, they were fixing everybody else's homes because it was revenue, and they didn't fix their own homes. So a lot of my builder members were living in, you know, pretty tough conditions, several months, if not a couple of years, some of them.
What did you find in yourself that you didn't know was there?
I was a leader, but a quiet leader. I was a point guard in basketball. I was a quarterback playing football, but I was a relatively quiet guy. That all went out the door because I couldn't be quiet, because I knew at that point I was the face of the organization. I was the advocate, and generally a quiet advocate is not an effective advocate. And so as I started cultivating media, then I started cultivating policymakers, the mayor of New Orleans, the council, the parish presidents, and all the council members and all the state reps and the governor and all these other people. I had to articulate both what we were going through and what we could provide to others, because we were one of the main players in all of this drama, so to speak. They needed us. And I get a call one day. The phone lines, I think, been somewhat restored. And it's this gentleman with this really deep voice. And he said, "You don't know me, but your name's been recommended to me. And my name is Eugene Schreiber." And he said, "I'm the general manager of the New Orleans World Trade Center." And he said, "I've heard you're dealing with a lot of housing issues." He said, "Is there a chance we can meet?" "Sure." So I go to meet him at the World Trade Center in New Orleans, right at the foot of the river. And it's now a Four Seasons hotel. It was the grandfather I needed in my life at that time. And he took me under his wing, and I provided him as much information as I possibly could. That started to then matriculate into, "Hey, John, I've got some people coming in from Quebec, some business leaders, and their assistant minister of interior, blah 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 blah. Could they come and meet with you?" "Sure." Well, I would usually go to his office, and we would meet there. "Hey, John, a week later, I got some people coming in from Beijing, some business leaders, some of their political people and some of their policymakers, Sure. Well, that turned into probably meetings with folks from over 70 or 80 countries. And they were all flocking here because they saw an opportunity to redesign and reimagine an entire American city. It was a blank slate. And so they all had theories of construction and products that they wanted to introduce here in the market and so forth. And I never said no to any of them. My mantra was, if you are serious and if you're genuine about this technical theory of design, where they wanted to bring, particular components of a home and assemble them on site, or they wanted to do structured insulated panels and all these other theories and all these other products, I said two things. "You better get your boots on the ground here," I said, "because things move so fast and so fluid." I said, "If you're not here, you're not going to be able to do it remotely from Beijing or Krakow, Poland, or Quebec, Canada, or Sydney, Australia. You're going to have to be here." I said, and then you're going to have to educate our community, our builders, because a lot of what you're proposing isn't heretofore how we have built for the last couple of 100 years in New Orleans." Many of them did. Get a presence here. They became members of my association. So all of a sudden, my membership blows back up, which I was thrilled. Now, I knew they were probably going to be relatively temporary, maybe a few years, but I'll take them. So we go well over 1,000 members at that point. We had gone down to 600 or 700. We're over 1,000 members now, so that's cool.
To what extent did their products and their services and approaches and knowledge and to what extent did that stick? Can you see any of that today?
Yeah, a lot of it washed out, honestly. But some of the different panelized and compartmentalized techniques to construction were brought to, to into the community and kind of absorbed and so forth. Some of the different products, whether they might be insulation products, there was a company out of Canada that had a really cool insulation called Isonene, and so different things like that hit and stuck. And so it could be product based, probably more product based than construction based in the way we did construction, because while all of this is also going on, none other than Mr. Brad Pitt came into town, and Brad Pitt is going to essentially, and his group is going to tell everybody how they're going to rebuild what was called the Lower Ninth Ward, which got completely wiped out. But prior to that, had been one of the higher home ownership regions in the whole city, because folks, owned their homes and they took great pride in it. And they were all, probably 95% African American communities, multi-generational homeowners there, and but that's where he was going to plant his flag and did. And so I got to know all of his folks. They became a member of our organization. However, they immediately started broaching issues that weren't even remotely close or recognizable to how the community had been built the previous 150 years. And even more so that my builders were willing to even embrace. We also knew we had to now, the lenders, the national lenders were demanding we have a uniform statewide building code, which we hadn't had prior to that. So that was all going on. the builders were initially resisting that and saw, well, no, we can't, we're not going to be able to fight this one. So then we had to get to Baton Rouge and lobby the best legislation we could, so to make sure that they didn't completely regulate us out of business. That was all going on. We had all the flooding. We had to work a lot with FEMA, and they were doing these so-called base flood elevations, and then the National Flood Insurance Protection, or the NFIP insurance. So we're dealing with all of that. If you had one regulator, they might want you to raise the rebuild, 12 feet in the air, when it might not have been necessary. Where that so there were so many overreactions and so much oversteering, and so it was my job, our job, my builder's job. It was our job to kind of bring it back to center. But then my guys didn't want to move at all. So my job was to try to bring them back to center lots of times mostly on these policy issues.
Hold on a second. I want to ask you something, because you hit the ground running. I mean, as soon as you got that haircut, it's like game on, right?
Yeah, I like it.
One of the things that we haven't talked a lot about was, I mean, your family, you had extended family that lost everything. Do you find that this agency to do something is what helped you kind of get through this period of trauma?
No, no doubt. And I think my background, Churchill had a really, really good quote, and I know I'll mangle it, but when he finally got to be prime minister, and he was 60s, whatever he was, he said something to the effect that my whole life's been a preparation for this moment and in this time. And I thought about it, because I used to be a big Churchill guy. I thought about this. You know, like I said, initially I cracked like everybody else. Then I got my hair cut and I mourned my deaths. And I said, I got to get on it. I knew I was the man for that time, for that job. Didn't make it easier. Didn't mean I didn't go home and cry some nights. But, and didn't mean that, my wife and I didn't hug tighter and like, what are we going to do? Kind of deal. But I was always able to recover that next day or that next day or that next day and just keep plugging, keep pushing. I think that's my athletic background as well. I was a pretty good athlete, but I wasn't a phenomenal athlete. But I was a dog, and I was a point guard, and I ended up being able to play Division I basketball. And most of that was on desire and just sheer want to versus talent.
It's interesting to me that almost because you were already and recently placed into that place of authority, right? You had a responsibility that was bigger than yourself when the bomb dropped, or the hurricane, which was essentially a bomb. And the reason I bring that up is because one of the things that fascinates me and that I'm interested in is, how do we get through it without it basically destroying our lives? And one of the things you mentioned, Churchill, I remember World War II, listening to someone speak about how there was such a lack of depression and anxiety, ironically, in Great Britain when the bombs were dropping.
Well, during the Blitz, right.
The
right.
Blitz, because they had a job to do, and how important of a message that is. Everybody was kind of doing their thing and whatever their job was.
That's
and so I just wanted to kind of take a moment and put a pin in that, because you're very exemplary in that moment. And I love the Ken Ford, what do you say? Make a damn decision, or make some damn decisions.
Make some damn decisions. Yeah.
Doesn't matter whether they're right or wrong. I love that.
It was pretty apparent that there are enough people out there locally, statewide, nationally, the world, who really wanted to build New Orleans back green and more resilient, more energy efficient. And I wasn't against that. My builders, a lot of them, kind of a knee jerk, they were. That became a multi-year negotiation, so to speak, because I saw merits from both sides. I saw where, heck yeah, we could build more efficiently. A lot of these products that came in from all over the world had an environmental bent to them, green or otherwise. And so my job then was to make that make sense to my builders. It took a lot of back and forth. And again, I'll fast forward real quickly. I was able to create within our organization a so-called Green Building Council. You talk about people flocking from all over the world here because they wanted to be a part of the opportunity. A lot of young, very successful professionals did so. They could have worked in Manhattan on Wall Street. They could have worked in Chicago, LA, you name it. They came here because they were very altruistic. They wanted to do good, and they wanted to do well. Well, I started hiring some of these folks on my staff at the Home Builders Association. And as much as they likely learned from me, I learned from them, because they were showing me that you can make productive increments of change, so to speak, that are productive and yet still do it affordably, still do it so the mass consumer, all the consumers can still participate in it. And so, I'd venture to say after another 3 or 4 years, that was all my staff. All my staff were like that. A lot of them from other places that, they came here because they truly wanted to make a difference. But these are very bright people. None of these changes happened like overnight, as you might imagine. This was real incremental kind of stuff.
So
That, and
John,
I look back on it,
oh, sorry. So I
no.
have a question about these brilliant, idealistic, do well, do good people whom you embraced, right? And so here are these people arriving with all this idealism in the place where they can make a difference, and you're watching them go through a process of figuring out whether that idealism is going to be applicable or whether
Sure.
they're going to walk away disillusioned. So what was that?
What I learned to do, I would sit down with my staff and go through my budget with them. And I would show them where my revenue streams were coming from, all my income line items, and then I would show them my expenses. And I would say, that might be a pretty good idea, but it's going to cost, you're telling me it's probably going to cost X. We're not budgeted for that. How is it going to derive income for us? Are we going to make any kind of money? We can't lose money on it. We can net out even. We're a nonprofit, C6, that we're allowed to make money. So how is that going to work? And that used to get their attention because that idealism started to kind of fade a little bit because they couldn't answer me lots of times. New Orleans and even most of the state of Louisiana on a per capita basis is one of the poorest areas and regions in the nation. So we better get the pencils back out, sharpen them up again and figure out how we can still make these improvements, energy efficiency, green, what have you, but still make them so they're affordable. Did a ton of media, but I was doing this live TV show. It was on Sunday nights at 10:30 p.m. and it was called The Hot Seat. And a longtime legendary anchor named Norman Robinson, he would host it. And it would be whatever topic du jour. Well, all of the topics for a long time on the hot seat were Katrina related, rebuilding related, whatever. So that then evolved into me doing the hot seat almost every Sunday for months, if not years. Well, one night my cell phone rings and I had at that time saved it. And I'm with this big group from most of them were out of town. And I look and I see it's Norman Robinson. Well, this is Sunday, say, I don't know, 7 p.m. And the show, if when I would appear on that show, I'd usually have to get there about 9:30 and we'd go on at 10:30 and we'd do it half hour. Well, it's Norman. I excused myself. I said, I gotta take this. And he said, oh man, he said, emergency. He said, I had somebody drop out. I need you. I said, okay. I said, I'm in town. I can get this done. And he said, I just want to warn you. I said, okay. He said, you're gonna debate a professor from LSU, and her whole theory is that we should be building houses that when winds and or when water intrusion comes, the houses rise. They're on these risers that that will avoid getting flooded. I said, okay. And that's that. So I go in there and she was a lovely lady. And immediately in my mind, I'm thinking, I don't want to come off looking like a thug. I don't want to come off looking like a bully. I don't believe for a second what she's proposing is meaningful or relevant. So she goes into her mantra about being over in the Netherlands and spending a lot of time over there. And she was an engineering professor at LSU. And so she was talking about these rising houses and, it's the phenomenon over there and all this other kind of stuff. And I'm just taking it all in. And the guy Norman's just kind of looking at me because he would kind of stand there with his microphone and, he's kind of looking at me, and then finally he said, "Well, John, what do you think? What do the builders think about that?" And I said, I complimented her probably for the first 30 seconds about her expertise and all this other kind of thing, and then I took us back to the Netherlands for a second, and then I brought us back here, and I said, "I love the ingenuity. I love the her pushing the envelope." I said, "But let's assume these floodwaters are coming in early when we're on the eastern side of the eye, the hurricane eye. That's the first thing these way. Okay, let's assume our houses go up. Great, they're not going to flood." I said, "But you know what follows that are 140, 150 mile an hour winds." I said, "So that house that rose is going to end up about 400 yards down the pike." I'm sure she didn't love it, but it was as amicable as it could have been. Well, there are all kinds of instances like that where I really truly wouldn't dismiss concepts and things outright. again, my constituency would lots of times, and they're probably right to just eliminate it and move on. I probably took too much time sometimes considering some of these things.
Well, and to your point, you'd never know which one of these crazy, wacky ideas is going to stick.
Right.
And some of the craziest ideas, like we assume, are completely normal now. Like all
Right.
those concepts, you just don't know.
Yeah,
And so
you
it's I'm
don't.
so glad that Louisiana had you at the helm at a time
Yeah.
where construction was at this point of rebirth, where there was such
Yeah.
opportunity, and with opportunity comes opportunists. And
Right, right,
having
right.
to sift through that, I think it's a pretty astounding, thing that you were tasked with, and it sounds like you
Yeah.
were clearly ready for it in your
Yeah.
Churchill way.
I think a lot of times after disasters, there's this feeling of what can I do? Right? How can I help? What can I do to make a difference? I mean, once you have your
Yes.
personal situation for the most part,
Right.
taken care of, most people don't have the levers of influence that you do. Did you have that moment of, I know you just got right into it, but was there a moment of, even up till today, where you look back and you said, well, have I pulled those levers the way that I wanted to, right? I mean, did I, since I had all of this in front of me, how did that go? Because I think a lot of people think, oh, I just wish I could have done more.
I, for the most part, came out of the experience and to this day feeling like I tapped into just about everything that I could have probably at the time and place could have tried to, execute. I tell you what is an indicator of some things, and this is my whole, I was at the HBA after that for another 14, 15 years. And so I was there almost 16 years, I guess. And it was Hurricane Katrina and Rita and Gustav and Ike and Isaac. And then I started reporting out to Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm in New York, and Hurricane Maria in San Juan, Puerto Rico, because I had developed this expertise in, preparedness, number one, and then recovery, number two. I didn't think about it. It just made sense for me to share all of this knowledge that I had acquired, because I acquired a lot of it the hard way. That's probably one of the things I'm most proud of as in retrospect, is being able to share that wisdom. And the preparedness piece was far more important than the recovery piece to me. And that's what I would try to really emphasize, both when I was on the ground in San Juan or in Hurricane Harvey in Houston. That was a rain event. There were elements to all of these things that I had learned, that there are some preventative things we can be looking at. Don't wait until a disaster hits to know who your local floodplain manager is, and your FEMA representative, and your SBA rep, and your local codes officials, and your local planning people. Don't wait till then for a disaster to hit, because guess what? You're never going to make contact with them. Never, never, never. You might already know them and still not make contact with them, but you're giving yourself a fighting chance if you already have relationships with these people.
What would you say are the two most critical things to do right now for any homeowner? And I'm talking about the homeowner, not the person that's out there, in your
Yeah,
position.
I would evaluate my property and flood insurance. I would evaluate all of the limitations, all of the exemptions. I would see truly and try to think about, all the eventualities, a category two hurricane all the way to a category five, or a tornado or a flood or whatever. And what do you look like during that time, frankly? And I would advise to truly, with that, do some house hardening and everything if possible. But then I would also really look at, what are your reserves look like? That, what are your family reserves look like? And most of us, a lot of people, don't live with a whole lot of financial reserve that could get them through 2 or 3 or 4 months. And to me,
Right.
those are, at the end of the day, if you don't have good insurance and you don't have money, you're in trouble. You're gonna have a hard time rebuilding, if you get hit. And those are the two things that just come out immediately to mind, at least.
We covered the preparedness, and now for the final question. So,
Yep.
and this is interesting because of somebody with your breadth of knowledge and experience, from the 30,000 foot perspective.
Yeah.
But what would you tell somebody that calls you up and says, "John, I just lost my house 5 minutes ago. What should I do?"
Called Build SOS, right?
I
There you
didn't.
go.
There
No,
you
seriously,
go.
seriously, in all seriousness, I would immediately put them in touch with my people, so to speak. If it's somebody I really know well, I would immediately have them in touch with anybody in the trades that would be able to, to impact the tragedy that just befell them. Again, whether it might be a banker that I know that they really need to look at financing, or a builder, or a craftsman, or a tradesman, or whatever the case may be. A group, obviously, like Build SOS, when somebody who has experience with these things that are doing these, daily, frankly.
Man of action, always to the very end. I love that. And you know what? You're talking about that social capital, but it's also, intellectual capital. It's why we're doing this podcast, so people know where to go, what to do. Thank you so much for taking the time, man. I
No,
really
thank
appreciate
you. I
it.
enjoyed it. I hope we can stay in touch regardless.
Thanks, John. All
All right,
right,
thank you
John.
guys.
Thanks
Take
so
care.
much.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for listening to Disaster Diaries. And if you're moved by these stories, please like, subscribe, leave a review. That will really help us. And also, please share the show with somebody that you think needs it. To tell your own story, download the Disaster Diaries app, available at all app stores, or visit disasterdiaries.com. And if you're looking for help rebuilding, check out buildsos.com for support, tools, and resources to help you better prepare for, respond to, and recover from disasters. Hey there. Just a reminder that this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not legal, financial, or insurance advice. Disaster Diaries and Build SOS do not endorse any specific products, services, methods, or guest viewpoints discussed here. So please, always consult qualified professionals for decisions related to disaster preparedness, construction, or insurance.